Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Jim, thanks for having me back, and thanks for everyone listening in.
Is this a good time to get into the oil patch?
Well, we've had a nice move here this summer in crude oil, and even natural gas has bounced off the bottom. So we've had a move up in the energy stocks, and we kind of see this as part of a longer-term sort of bull market that started in mid-2020. I know there's been a pullback last year, but the trend still seems to be higher. However, I think we're getting towards sort of the later stages of that longer bull market, and we're not in the use of baseball analogy, we're not in the ninth inning, I don't think, but we're not in the early days. So at this point, we're starting to see a divergence, you know, between like winners and losers. And whereas like back in middle 2020, we know that when oil on the futures markets went into negative territory for a day, after that, you know, the whole sector kind of moved higher once crude rallied. I don't think we're going to get those kind of moves again where all the boats get lifted by a rising crude price, because the environment is now much more volatile, and you know, a lot has changed structurally. You know, for example, you know, in Canada we're going to have hopefully the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion next year in operation, knock on wood. So that's like a positive structural change, you know, and so there's both positive and negative changes. So this is, I think, calling for, being a little picky in terms of the stocks that one may be considering in the oil patch. And, you know, what, you know, we look to, of course, is our Ink Edge criteria, which we look at valuations, how much, you know, insiders are buying and holding, we call that an insider commitment, and price momentum, which is kind of a good take on overall market sentiment towards that stock. So what we look for are, you know, the stocks that are in that top 30%, ideally in the top 10%. And now, we don't look at like the fundamentals of a project, or, you know, the fundamentals of well economics. You know, we leave that up to the fundamental analyst. But generally, how you can use our signals is a conviction check, right? If you really love a project, and, you know, that's always a behavioral issue that, you know, most of us struggle with from time to time, getting kind of attached one way or another to a stock. And that's never really a good idea. You always want to kind of look at it day by day and think, okay, if I were starting today, would I buy this stock? And if you look at our Ink Edge rankings, and if they're sunny or mostly sunny, well, that's kind of confirming your positive view. But if it's like rainy or cloudy, which puts them in the bottom 10 or bottom 30% of our rankings, I think it really serves as a reality check on a positive outlook on a stock, even if you think the fundamentals are good, because maybe some structural changes have happened. Maybe you bought it based off of, you know, statements that management has made that aren't panning out. So that's how we use it. And what we've noticed is that lately, there's fewer stocks in the oil patch. There's there's 128 in the stocks that we cover in the Canadian oil patch. And there's 58 of them that have a sunny or mostly sunny. So that's like 58 stocks are in the top 30%. And so that's just under half. So it's still not bad. You know, it's still pretty good. But it's not like 50%, not or 60% of the stocks are in that category. You know, it's a minority now, small, you know, a big, you know, big good representation. But it just goes to point out that it is getting a little harder to find really good opportunities based off of our signals. And when you combine that with our Inc. Energy Indicator, which looks at the number of stocks by key buying by insiders versus key selling, it's under 100%. It's actually approaching 70%. So we're seeing insider profit taking pick up. Again, in a bull market, that's not to be that is expected. That's not a big surprise, but it still, you know, shows that maybe there is room to take some money off the table and maybe redeploy it towards names that still, you know, have good insider activity, good valuations, you know, and the market still likes. So it is time to be picky. We get into that in our Inc. Energy report for August, which we published actually on the last day of the month, in August on Thursday. So yeah, for those who are members of the Canadian Insider Club, take a look at that.
Is Canada's energy sector optimistic overall?
Overall, yes. Not as optimistic in terms of price, you know, prices. When I mean prices, I mean stock prices as they were earlier in the year when stocks were struggling. Remember, insiders are usually contrarian, so they're going to be more optimistic about their stock prices going up after their stock prices have gone down, right? So, you know, after a stock's been rallying for 52 weeks and is at all-time highs, you may be seeing some profit taking, saying suggesting they're not as optimistic that the stock can keep going up. So that's kind of how we look at it. But yes, in general, the Canadian oil patch is still pretty good, much better than the American oil patch, where our indicator is below 50%. And I think it reflects a lot of things between the two. You know, that we are seeing some structural improvements in Canada, you know, with that TMX pipeline, for example. And in the U.S., you have the political risk with the Biden administration. You never know what they're going to do next.
Now, the Canadian dollar around the 73-cent mark compared to the U.S. dollar, is that a reflection on the Canadian economy? Because usually there's some kind of connect between energy prices and the Canuck buck. Is there a disconnect there, or is it just poor government policy, or is there something else behind a lower Canadian dollar?
Well, I think over the past decade, the dollar, Canadian dollar, has become not only sensitive to energy prices, but I also think real estate money flows from China and elsewhere. Not, you know, it's not just China, but China's a big investor. So, you know, I think that explains a lot. And you know, with the Chinese real estate market, you know, probably having peaked. The source of inflows into Canada from China for real estate are not going to be as strong as they used to be. I don't think it's going to dry up by any stretch. And, you know, we also have some restrictions in place, which are, you know, are they having any impact? I'll let someone else comment on that. I'm skeptical because there's apparently, I think unless I'm to be corrected, foreign buyers can still buy vacation homes. So, but in general, though, I think it's, you know, the macro environment in China, or the real estate environment, I think the macro environment in China is getting overly, the West is becoming overly pessimistic about the overall Chinese economy, but the real estate group in China is definitely, it has some challenges, and it's going to take a long time to work out those challenges. And I think that's on the margin, that's a negative for the Canadian dollar. And, you know, I think you'd need to see the oil price really, you know, break higher for it to compensate for that. And maybe we'll get that. We'll have to see. We'll have to see if oil can break out of its range here. Certainly, though, just, you know, circling back to the oil patch, you know, with if oil and prices can stay in this range. There's still a lot of companies that can do okay. Not some companies are not so okay, but again, that gets back to the divergence between the winners and losers. So, yeah, the oil patch would benefit from stronger oil prices. Canadian dollar would benefit from stronger oil prices, and we probably need to see that if there's any hope for the Canadian dollar to, you know, break up towards that 80 cent level, and that's, you know, that's going to be a tough wall to climb.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, what's going on in the stock market that's caught your eye?
Well, we've got this ongoing debate, narrative debate between is inflation heading back towards the old, I call it the old Bernanke days of, you know, the previous decade, where it's going to settle back to 2%, and we're just going to have this kind of slow growth, and all you have to do is buy tech stocks and bonds, and that's basically your portfolio allocation. There is a huge amount there's a large group of investors who believe that, want that to happen, whatever the case may be, and you don't have to go very far on Twitter or YouTube to find some very high profile analysts and strategists pumping U.S. treasuries, and, you know, I don't know if they get a commission from the U.S. treasuries for all their pumping of U.S. bonds. I'm joking. As far as I know, U.S. the government doesn't pay commission for their bonds, but maybe one day they might have to, but no, I'm just joking. But the other side is that inflation is more structural. It's going to stay higher for longer, and that, yes, even if the U.S. economy slows down a bit, inflation is going to be higher, so bond yields should be higher than where they are now, because they're still, you know, there's still this belief that that inflation is going to just go back to 2% and growth is going to flatline. So that's in the process of working out. But, you know, what we are keeping a really close eye on is the gold-silver ratio, which looks at the price of gold over the price of silver. And it has tried five times now this year to take out its a 6-month low, basically 6-month low level around 78, 76, just 77 on that ratio. And that ratio is on CanadianInsider.com, by the way. It's free to take a look at. But we're looking for that to break lower. If it does break lower, then I think it's off to the races for the junior miners and the mining industry and other commodities as well. It is having a hard time breaking lower, though. And so it may not break lower. It may break higher, and because it's also kind of been trying to break through its 6-month high, which is, you know, around 87. So we're in this kind of 10-point range on the gold-silver ratio. So I'd keep a close eye on that. You know, if you know, we think there's light at the end of the tunnel. That's the question we ask in our Inc. Top 20 Mining Report, which we also published today, and you can get that on Canadian Insider if you remember. We think that it is going to break lower. Insider sentiment is still very high in the mining industry, and I just think that, you know, those who are anchored in the Bernanke period are going to be disappointed for a whole bunch of reasons that we've talked about in previous reports and on this podcast before, as you'll probably remember, Jim. And so we think it will break lower, but we don't know when. If I knew when, that would be great. But, you know, it may take another year. Let's hope not. But, you know, that will be the market forces that determine that. We've got some big data, some more. And when people come back from their summer break next week, we'll get more price action. The other thing I want to watch, I'm watching very closely, is the money center U.S. banks. You know, we're talking about the big ones. Citibank's chart is looking pretty iffy. You know, it's rallied here the last week or so, but it's kind of, you know, it's rolling over. It was rolling over earlier today, and I'd watch Citigroup. and see how that's doing, because it's not hasn't been behaving that well over the past month. And so if the money center banks start to head back to those lows we saw in March, that would also be a concern. And until the Fed kind of throws in the towel on this rate hike stuff, and I think Jerome Powell missed a big opportunity in Jackson Hole to set out a framework for his policy going forward. Instead, he talked about not being able to, you know, see the stars through the clouds, which is, you know, just which I thought was a complete missed opportunity and kind of a bizarre thing to say. But in any event, if the money center banks force Jay Powell's hand, like, why would they be weakening? I don't know. Like, I'm not a bank analyst. I don't profess to have any specific insights into that, except that I can look at the charts, and the charts on that stock, for example, does not look very good. And everyone was talking about the regional banks. So no one was really paying attention to the money center banks. But in the next 2 months, I'd be watching the gold silver ratio for, you know, possible inflationary breakout. But I've also be watching the money center banks for a possible deflationary situation, which would force the Fed's hand, because above all, Jim, they want to protect the U.S. Banking system, and that's, you know, part of their unwritten mandate, but it's a very important one for them. And they do not want the banking sector to be in trouble. We saw that how quickly they responded in March, and we suspect that they would respond quickly again if there was any other issues there. So I'm afraid we're in for a very volatile fall, and I know there's a lot of the big U.S. bank analysts are talking about a big stock market rally coming up here in the fall. I mean, I hope they're right, but we don't see it in our insider sentiment. U.S. insider sentiment is pretty bearish right now. It's consistent with a bearish index, a broad index. You know, there's always opportunities at the stock level. We try our best to identify those. But, U.S. insider sentiment's not looking very good right now. But, keep an eye on those money center banks and the gold-silver ratio.
Electric cars, we thought there'd be a huge demand for the commodities that go into them, things like copper, zinc, lead, everything you need for batteries. That have we seen that, and do we expect that to pick up?
Well, it depends. I guess it depends on kind of what gauge you're looking at. I mean, there's a bunch of different lithium prices, so you know, and it's kind of a, I don't call it a murky market. It's just, it's a very fragmented market. So I think one has to be careful at looking at lithium prices. You know, the copper price has been hurt by the situation with the China housing. Okay, so housing was a big driver of copper demand, and China is the biggest copper consumer in the world. So copper's been hurt by this real estate situation. But there are reports, and I tweeted one out from a Bank of America analyst, I believe, was in China, indicating that they believe that copper demand, because of the EV revolution in China, and it is growing in China. I know here it's kind of like you see a Tesla here and there, and you're seeing some of these charging stations pop up. But in China, the EV penetration is soaring. And they believe that China is going to have double-digit growth for copper over the next few years, and it's in double-digit growth this year. But you wouldn't know it looking at the copper price. So, to be honest with you, I don't know what's going on with the copper price. And, you know, what's going to happen, I guess, at some point, shortages will materialize, and then copper will go flying higher. But by then, it'll be too late, because, as you know, Jim, and all your listeners here know, you can't just turn on a copper mine. It's not like oil, you know, where, okay, OPEC, you know, wants to increase capacity, okay, Saudi Arabia will bring on 1 million barrels a day next month, and everything, you know, will calm the oil price down. So it's not going to work that way with copper. I mean, so at some point, it's going to get very interesting, I think, especially if this this lady from Bank of America was right in terms of China copper demand. But yeah, we'll have to see. It's just taking a long time to play out, I think.
And of course, too, recently we've seen governments turn down major mining developments in Canada, which
right.
is kind of disappointing.
Well, yeah.
And yet they want people to drive electric cars.
By the way, that analyst name is Maddie Zhao, Z-H-A-O, and it is on my, I posted on Twitter on the 21st of August, and it's a link to an interview she gave on Bloomberg, so it's worth watching for those who are interested in that, in the copper demand thing. Yeah, in Canada, as we talked about a couple of shows ago, the provinces, you know, are kind of off doing their own thing. They haven't got the memo, and I'll exclude BC from that. Unfortunately, BC doesn't have any lithium to speak of. But the I think the framework that the EB government and, you know, it was started under Horgan with the First Nations, bringing First Nations into the kind of exploration process, it's showing signs of working. But look, mining companies have to stay on top of their First Nations relationships, and that's not easy. And we've seen examples in BC of a company. We saw one company, and it never really made it high on our rankings, but I'm not going to mention the name, but it got caught with a surprise development with one of the First Nations groups that have territory in the project area, and you know, that's you got to be on top of it. And then there's others that, you know, strike deals that hold, and they're able to get multi-year permits, drilling permits, but it is a very tricky business. It's an important business, but if you can manage it right in BC, it can actually, I think, be a net positive to help you get approvals and get a mining license. We've got a major major gold mine that's going to probably start production in central British Columbia next year, and basically it's the Blackwater mine in central BC, and it's a big mine, and they got their permits this year, and it didn't, once they got the right management team involved with this mine project, it got going, and so it can be done in British Columbia. I'm not so optimistic in Quebec. When you have the federal government approving the Galaxy mine ahead of the Quebec government, and the Quebec government still hasn't approved it, when you've got, there's a junior miner I know that's still waiting on their bulk permit, their bulk sampling permit that they applied for in the fall, you know, there are problems in Canada, you know, in some of these provinces with on the regulatory side. So it is an issue, and but it's not just Canada. I mean, the U.S. I don't think is much better, but the U.S. is state by state. Well, in Canada, it's kind of province by province. So yeah, the West is, you know, it's a Western disease, right? This kind of bureaucratic red tape disease where, you have one arm of government saying EV transition, let's go for it. We don't want to be, we want to diversify from China. But you've got these other parts of government that say, well, wait a minute, not in my backyard. You know, what about the salmon over here, and what about the foliage over here? You know, it's kind of a dysfunctional situation in Western democracies right now, and there doesn't seem to be the political leadership to really treat. You know, to really treat it like a climate emergency, which it's framed as, and, you know, whether one believes that or not, just let's agree that that's what politicians call it. Well, if it really is an emergency, you know, you have to act like it's an emergency, and you have to get these projects done. But that's, you know, those are still the exceptions, not the rules. So, but does that come back? It comes back to your question about the commodities. Eventually, yeah, I I got to see that copper is going to keep going unless we throw in the towel on the climate emergency and say, well, we didn't really need all those EV cars, you know, and, oh, we spent all those money on those battery factories, but, you know, now something else has come along. And I don't think there is going to be something else for a while that comes along. It's either they throw in the towel and go back to hybrids, or we're going to have these big commodity shortages. But when is that going to happen, Jim? I don't know. Maybe it's going to happen around the time the gold-silver ratio breaks below its recent lows. So we'll have to see.
Ted, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, Jim, for having me back.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news. You can find him online at CanadianInsider.com and on Twitter at InkResearch. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network, find us on Twitter at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.